Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Michael, reading from the Big Bend Sentinel. Coronavirus, live updates for the Big Bend region. Updated November 5th. In a news release on Thursday, state officials announced that the dates of some upcoming Tri-County testing sites have been revised. The locations and times for the Alpine and Fort Davis testing sites are still the same, but the timing of the Presidio and Marfa testing sites have changed. Here's the updated information. Marfa, Tuesday, November 10th, drive-through, Presidio County Courthouse, 300 North Highland Street, Marfa. Presidio, Wednesday, November 11th, walk-up, City of Presidio EMS and Fire Station, 100 East FM 170. Alpine, Thursday, November 12th, walk-up, Alpine Fire Station, 102 South Street. Fort Davis, Friday, November 13th, walk-up, Fort Davis Fire Station, 200 Court Avenue. State officials are now recommending that people pre-register at least 24 hours before the Marfa site at www.curative.com. All the sites will use oral swab tests and will run from 9 a.m. until 4 p.m. or until capacity is reached. As usual, ID is required, but appointments aren't. Coronavirus update published November 4th. Presidio County Judge Cinderella Guevara on Wednesday morning announced 37 new cases in Presidio County, bringing the total local confirmed case count to 188. It's the largest spike in local counts in Presidio County since the coronavirus pandemic began, but it adds just 8 new cases to the state's count, which on Tuesday night was reporting 180 cases. In her news release, Judge Guevara once again warned that people violating quarantine orders could face misdemeanor charges for deadly conduct. This reiterates the need for personal responsibility, she wrote. You must protect yourself and others. The new cases are overwhelmingly from South County, with 29 new cases in Presidio and 5 in Redford, compared to just 3 in Marfa. Of the new cases, 6 were children or teenagers, including 4 people in Presidio and 2 in Marfa. Texas Stays Red, Presidency Still Undetermined, by Stephen Paulson, published November 4th. Late on Tuesday night, Associated Press called Texas for Donald Trump, and yet at press time, Joe Biden still had several avenues for victory in the Electoral College, including through flips in Arizona and Georgia, or through a narrow victory in the once Democratic strongholds in the Rust Belt. As polls showed a tight race in the Lone Star State, Texas found itself in an unlikely position as a possible swing state in one of the most polarizing elections in recent history. But Biden never banked on Texas for victory, with advertising spending here relatively low compared to true battleground states like Florida. And many Texas Democrats, jaded from years of talk of Texas turning blue, were wary of getting their hopes up. Those instincts proved correct. At press time on Wednesday morning, more than 5.8 million Texans had voted for Trump versus around 5.2 million who voted for Biden. With around 96% of ballots now counted in the state, the results give Trump a statewide victory with around 52% of the vote. At the local level, Presidio stayed a Democratic stronghold, with both Trump and Biden earning more votes than was the case in 2016. Brewster County stayed Republican, and Jeff Davis County even more so. Several rural counties even appeared to have flipped for the incumbent president, including Reeves County in West Texas, Valverde in Central Texas, and Kennedy County in South Texas. The rightward drift in South Texas, where at least 7 counties appeared to be flipping from Clinton in 2016 to Trump in 2020, is particularly noteworthy, considering the region was hard hit by coronavirus just months ago. After months of anticipation, election night was in general a disappointment for Texas Democrats. At press time, the Big Bend Sentinel is also reporting this week Democrats had either lost or appeared to be losing not only the statehouse contest, but several closely watched U.S. congressional districts, including Texas 23, where Democrat Gina Ortiz Jones conceded to Tony Gonzalez on Wednesday morning. Texas saw historic voter turnout this year, as many young urban voters chose Biden. Suburban areas in Houston, Austin, and Dallas-Fort Worth continued their leftward drift. But in the end, it wasn't enough for a Democratic rout in the state, even in the smaller down-ballot races. Viewed another way, the statewide elections were also a reminder of just how gargantuan Texas is. At press time, there were more Biden voters in Texas than in New York, with around 5.2 million in Texas and 4.2 million in New York. Almost four times as many people voted for Biden in Texas than in Arizona, where, despite being a key battleground state, the Democratic challenger had racked up just around 1.4 million votes at press time. In short, despite Democratic dreams in Texas, the Lone Star State stayed red. It was a microcosm of the scene across the country, where Democrats hoping for a landslide against Trump's presidency instead got a nail biter. But the Texas election was remarkable in other ways. At press time, Trump appeared to be carrying the state by just around 6 points, an even tighter margin than in 2016, when Trump defeated Clinton in the Lone Star State by around 9 points. Democrats will likely point to those results and argue, once again, that Texas could someday turn blue. But with a deeply polarizing incumbent president, it remains to be seen whether the close victory was just conservatives disapproving of Trump or a sign of bigger changes to come in the Lone Star State. Here's what the down-ballot races mean in the Tri-County. By Stephen Paulson, published November 4th. With polls showing a tight presidential race in Texas and with several swing congressional districts up for grabs, many Big Bend residents were focused on the national elections on Tuesday night. But even at the local level, several down-ballot races offered referendums on the future that residents want to see for the region. Take Jeff Davis County, where Republican Curtis Evans handily defeated Democrat Fred Dusty Rhodes in the race for county judge, 927 to 437. Evans, a current county commissioner, will replace temporary county judge Larry Francell, who was appointed after the sudden death of Judge Kareth Sproul Hurley earlier this year. That result may not be surprising. Jeff Davis County, after all, is the reddest part of the Tri-County. But the race is still probably the most noteworthy in the Tri-County, because it was largely a referendum on coronavirus restrictions like mask mandates. Many residents in Jeff Davis County see the state's rules as too restrictive and have flouted them. In Brewster County, meanwhile, unofficial results on Wednesday showed that incumbent Sheriff Ronnie Dodson had defeated challenger Will Draw in a landslide, with Dodson earning 3,888 votes to Draw's 645. Dodson, who won his first sheriff's election in Brewster County in 2000, will go on to serve for a sixth term. That sheriff's race was a wild one, replete with an FBI investigation, racist tweets, allegations of hacking, and a controversy over jail admittance. But with Dodson handily defeating Draw, it's unclear what effect, if any, those many controversies had on the race. Dodson is a popular incumbent who won in 2016 with over 83% of the vote. Draw, on the other hand, was a write-in challenger who entered the race late. It's possible his candidacy was kneecapped from the start. But Dodson, despite holding more conservative views on everything from gun rights to coronavirus mask mandates, is officially a Democrat. In a right-leaning county that has now gone twice for President Donald Trump, his re-election is a sign that, even in these partisan times, not all races are decided by the D or R next to a candidate's name on a ballot. In Marfa, four candidates, including two incumbents and two newcomers, were vying for three seats on Marfa City Council. Popular newcomer Eddie Payares got by far the most votes at 525. Next up were incumbent Buck Johnston, who earned 386, and incumbent Yosef Ben Yehuda, who won 359. The final candidate, newcomer Stephen Bolter, got 174, meaning he will not be joining City Council this year. Throughout Presidio County, including in Marfa, coronavirus restrictions haven't proved as divisive as elsewhere in the region and state. But there were still other contentious issues in Marfa, including a proposed ordinance on short-term rentals, which city officials have workshopped since early October. In our Meet the Candidate series, Bolter listed gentrification as his top concern in Marfa and came out strongly in favor of increased limits on short-term rentals. Ben Yehuda, on the other hand, has been wary of new restrictions, often questioning what the city hopes to gain from new short-term rental rules. Still, without much local campaigning in Marfa, it's unclear if that city council race came down to the issues or just name recognition. With the exception of Eddie Payares, a longtime Marfa resident with a wide base of support, the race appeared to lean in favor of incumbents. One Marfa race definitely came down to the issues, though. In a ballot initiative, Prop A, Marfa residents were asked whether they wanted to have more control in negotiations over electrical utility rates. By an overwhelming margin, Marfan said yes. More than 600 residents voted for that proposition, while just 117 voted against it. At both the county and district levels, there were also several uncontested races. Roy Ferguson, the incumbent district judge, won with 1,751 votes. In the district attorney's race, newcomer Ori White won with 1,125 votes after defeating incumbent Sandy Wilson in the Republican primary earlier this year. Brenda Bentley, Presidio County Commissioner for Precinct 1, won in with 381 votes. Jose Cabby Cabazuela won the race for Precinct 3 Commissioner with 239 votes. Likewise, in the uncontested constables races, Marfa Police Chief Steve Marquez and Adam Pujicovos Jr. won the races for Precincts 1 and 2, respectively. Things got more interesting in the countywide races, where despite some unchallenged races, there were still some discrepancies in how many votes candidates earned. That means some local voters didn't vote in all of those races, possibly signaling uncertainty or disapproval with the incumbents. Natalia Williams, who was running uncontested for the position of county tax assessor-collector, won her race with 1,780 votes. Compare that with Sheriff Danny Dominguez, who earned 1,690, and County Attorney Rod Ponton, who won 1,513. West Texas state seats got a little bluer, but Republicans locked down the U.S. congressional seat once more. By Abby Perot, published November 4th. While the county still awaits a final vote count for the 2020 presidential election, local ballots in West Texas have now been tabulated, with state races indicating that little will change along party lines this year. Across the region, candidates for Texas Senate Districts 19 and 29, Texas House District 74, and U.S. Congressional District 23 battled it out. But ultimately, most seats will stay in the hands of the same party, defying a second blue wave of Democratic wins that some projected for November 2020. Notably, Republicans were able to hold outgoing Congressman Will Hurd's seat in the 23rd U.S. Congressional District, a swing seat that has flipped across parties in recent years. Newcomer Republican Tony Gonzalez overcame Democrat Gina Ortiz Jones, despite the name recognition she has in the area due to her race for the seat in 2018. Jones was endorsed by Presidio Mayor John Ferguson and Marfa Mayor Manny Baeza, and in Presidio County, she scored more votes. But Gonzalez ran up his votes in other areas, locking down the R seat. Jones lost to Hurd by under 1,000 votes, but this time around, the Republicans were able to secure a much wider margin, locking down 147,469 votes to Jones's 135,415, creating a comfortable 4.3% margin for Gonzalez. "We were outspent, but we weren't outworked," said Gonzalez after a victory announcement. He credited the win to hard work on the campaign trail, backed up by his campaign's undertaking to make 500,000 phone calls, knock 27,000 doors, and visit all 29 counties in the district twice in the past 2 months. The scene played out differently in one West Texas state race, where Democrats were able to flip a state Senate seat, sending freshman Republican state senator Pete Flores packing. Flores took office after a special election in 2018, which came about following Democrat Carlos Uresti's resignation due to fraud and bribery convictions. The seat was a longtime stronghold for Democrats prior to Flores, and opponent Roland Gutierrez was able to score a 10,000-vote margin over Flores, despite the Democrat trailing behind Flores among Alpine voters. Gutierrez has previously served as a legislator in the state's House of Representatives, and his Democratic victory this time around is larger than an isolated win for the party, even if other seats remained untouched. Gutierrez's victory will break a supermajority in the Texas Senate, changing the way bills can be introduced. Elsewhere, in the seat vacated by Representative Pancho Navarez after the Democrat was caught dropping cocaine in an airport, Eddie Morales Jr. was able to hold down the border's Texas House District 74 for Democrats. In the most definitive win of the night in West Texas, El Paso Democrat Cesar Blanco handily defeated Republican business owner Bethany Hatch, nabbing 67% of the vote. Blanco is now moving out of the Texas House of Representatives and into the Senate in District 29, a seat long held by outgoing Democrat Jose Rodriguez. Short-term rental ordinance discussions prompt legal letter to city, by Stephen Paulson, published November 4th. Marfa City leaders are still working on a proposed short-term rental ordinance, but the draft document is already attracting the attention of lawyers. In a letter to city officials last month, Jeffrey Jackson, a real estate lawyer based in Houston, warned that Marfa's new proposed short-term rental rules are deeply flawed and could prompt legal challenges. As Marfa City Council irons out these rules, they've been wary of running into the problem seen across Texas, where short-term rental ordinances have led to court fights. In Austin, for example, a Texas appeals court last year threw out rules limiting the ability of non-homestead property owners to start short-term rentals. At the very first public workshop on Marfa's ordinance in October, Justin Bragiel, the general counsel for the Texas Hotel and Lodging Association, warned that far-right think tanks had been funding fights to overturn short-term rental rules across the state. As local elections conclude in Marfa, Jackson's letter to the city raises the specter of a similar legal fight happening here. Jackson's letter raises what he argues are several legal problems with the proposed ordinance. The current proposed rules are unconstitutionally vague for a number of reasons, he argues, including because the city hasn't been clear enough on what it means to operate a short-term rental. He argues this issue could lead to arbitrary and capricious enforcement against property owners for the actions of their guests, even if those owners live outside of Marfa. Jackson argues that the ability of property owners to open a short-term rental is a property right protected under the Due Process Clause and Equal Protection Clause, and would be subject to a high level of scrutiny. He cites a Texas Supreme Court opinion from 2018, in which the court ruled that turning a home into a short-term rental is still qualified as a residential use because visitors to short-term rentals engage in the same activities generally associated with a personal dwelling, including eating, sleeping, and bathing. Jackson also takes aim at Marfa's current trash rules, which classify garbage for short-term rentals as commercial, because those rentals operate as revenue-generating businesses. Jackson argues there is no rational basis for classifying short-term rental garbage as commercial, nor evidence that short-term rentals produce a higher quantity or unusual quantity of garbage. I have extensive experience in real estate law, especially in the area of residential property rights, Jackson writes. I encourage you to consider my opinion as part of your deliberations on the ordinance. In his email to the city, Jackson said he was sending his legal opinion at the request of concerned parties. Likewise, his legal letter says he was hired by concerned parties in the city of Marfa, but at press time, it was unclear who exactly those people are. When City Attorney Teresa Todd received the email in October, she thanked Jackson and asked him who he was representing. But on Monday, almost 2 weeks later, Todd said she still didn't know. When reached for comment on Tuesday, Jackson declined to comment on the identity of his clients. Unfortunately, he said, I'm not allowed to disclose who the interested parties are. When asked to further explain his legal concerns with the proposed Marfa ordinance, Jackson said he would need to check with his clients before answering questions from the press. In a follow-up email, he said he cannot provide further comment beyond the contents of his opinion letter. At a regular city council meeting last week, Marfa city officials initially planned to continue their discussions of the proposed short-term rental ordinance, but they ultimately focused on other business, instead setting up another workshop on the new rules. Marfa is holding its next workshop on the ordinance next Thursday, November 12th at 6 p.m. The meeting will be held over Zoom with login details to be released on the City of Marfa website. With new filings, court battle continues over Alpine Blocked Railroad Crossing Ordinance by Stephen Paulson, published November 4th. Alpine wants a federal court to throw out a lawsuit brought by Union Pacific over the city's blocked crossing ordinance. In court filings last week, Rod Ponton, the Alpine city attorney, disputed claims made by the company in a lawsuit filed against both him and the city of Alpine. Alpine is standing its ground on the ordinance, which imposes fines on train companies like Union Pacific if they block the 5th Street crossing in the center of town for more than 10 minutes. Union Pacific has argued that train traffic is regulated at the federal level and that Alpine city government can't impose rules on them. In September, Union Pacific sued. In court filings, Ponton pushes back on the company's claims. He argues that blocked crossings are essentially a local hazard, and because Alpine's ordinance is narrowly tailored to address this hazard, the rules do not impose an unreasonable burden on rail carriers or otherwise violate federal law, he argues. The city denies that this ordinance impermissibly regulates rail safety measures, including train speed, train length, and brake testing, that are covered under the Federal Railroad Safety Act, Ponton writes in court filings. Rather, the ordinance specifically regulates local health and safety measures. Ponton, who was named in the same lawsuit, argues in a separate motion that the case against him should be thrown out. He writes, he merely acts at the direction of the city of Alpine and has no discretion in carrying out or enforcing what is ultimately a lawful, duly passed ordinance. He called the lawsuit against him as superfluous and unnecessary. In a statement to the Big Bend Sentinel, Union Pacific said it was aware of the recent filings and hoped to continue to work with the city to reach a solution that does not involve ongoing litigation. The spokesperson did not comment on why Ponton was personally named in the case. The dispute between Alpine and Union Pacific dates back to at least March. That month, as the Big Bend Sentinel previously reported, Alpine passed an ordinance to fine train companies $1,000 if they blocked 5th Street crossing for more than 10 minutes, as well as $100 for each additional minute. Since then, Union Pacific racked up at least $17,000 in fines, which the company has said in court filings it's paid. According to Alpine Police, much of those fines came from a single incident this summer when Union Pacific blocked the crossing for hours. Back in March, only one city council member, Ramon Olivas, voted against the ordinance. In an interview with the Big Bend Sentinel at the time, he argued Alpine should continue negotiating with the company rather than adopting new penalties. But others in city government, including city manager Eric Zimmer, said there simply wasn't much left to negotiate. In a memo to the city, Union Pacific expressed safety concerns with our personnel crossing the street and said it would continue having its employees disembark at the 5th Street train platform, even if that blocked road traffic. In court filings, Alpine denies that Union Pacific was engaged in a productive discussion with the city and says the company instead turned down multiple potential solutions. In an order on Thursday, David Counts, the federal judge overseeing the case, gave Alpine and Union Pacific 30 days to agree on a trial date.
Hello, this is Cindy reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, October 29th. Arson suspected in old hospital fire by Nathan Hewer. Arson is suspected in the fire that lasted about 45 minutes on Wednesday, October 21st, at the old hospital building in Fort Stockton, which is now abandoned. The building is located at 405 North Spring Drive, right by the Middle Pecos Groundwater Conservation District office. It is going to be suspicious. The exact cause is still under investigation, Fort Stockton Fire Department Chief Jesse Dominguez said. This is our first arson case in a while. The fire chief added that no one was injured in the fire and the building was vacant upon arrival to the scene. The Fort Stockton Fire Department received a call regarding the fire at 11:16 a.m., and the fire was put out by noon. The building is owned by the county and, according to Dominguez, is potentially going to be demolished in the near future. With numerous recent fires, the fire chief also addressed arson concerns regarding other fires in recent time, stating that only fire that hasn't been ruled accidental is the KFC Taco Bell fire that happened on October 4th and the one on Wednesday. The KFC Taco Bell fire is still under investigation. This is for sure our first arson case of the year. All the other fires have been accidental except for KFC. That's still under investigation, Dominguez said. COVID-19. 5 additional deaths in county. Focused care nursing home outbreak increases by Nathan Hewer. COVID-19 active case numbers grew by 24 people, and 5 additional deaths occurred in Pecos County from October 20th to October 27th. The 5 Pecos County residents who passed away over the last 7 days, 84-year-old male who was a resident of the Focus Care Nursing Home in Fort Stockton, 74-year-old female, 73-year-old male who was a resident at FCNH, 91-year-old female, 81-year-old male. A majority of active coronavirus cases in Pecos County as of October 27th derived from the Focused Care Nursing Home in Fort Stockton. A total of 36 residents and workers combined have tested positive from COVID-19 at the nursing home, putting active case numbers outside of FCNH at 28, according to daily reports received by the Fort Stockton Pioneer. As of October 27th, there was 1 hospitalization at Pecos County Memorial Hospital. Pecos County Judge Joe Schuster addressed the spike in numbers in active cases and deaths at the Pecos County Commissioner's Court meeting on October 26th. Schuster iterated that Pecos County residents should not travel to Mexico for the time being to help stop the spread. The judge used El Paso's COVID-19 numbers of over 20% as an example. El Paso is over the 20% mark, and so that tells me that, one, they're on the border. This is my thinking. the close contact that is going on with Mexico. The El Paso people are coming and going across the border. Part of this is coming in from Mexico side, he said. What I would like to do here is cease all travel to Mexico until further notice. The recommendation will not be enforced, but is strongly recommended by the county judge. Based on the governor, it's a good faith thing. There's really not a whole lot of teeth into this order, other than we're asking you to make the right decision and not go back and forth to Mexico in the next 15 days, Schuster said. Bars and restaurants in town that were able to start serving alcohol a few weeks ago are also asked to comply with the guidelines set forth by the state in order to help stop the spread of the virus. Two rules in place that were noted at Schuster's and Mayor Chris Alexander's weekly COVID-19 update on October 22nd was that places serving alcohol need to stop serving alcoholic beverages at 11 p.m., and capacity should be no greater than 50%. Alexander said that if you see a place that is not complying, you are more than welcome to notify the Fort Stockton Police Department or the City of Fort Stockton. As for county totals to date since the pandemic started, 395 people have tested positive. Out of a total of 2,510 people tested, 15.7%, 26 tests are pending as of October 27th. The death total for Pecos County is now at 13, and of those who have tested positive, 318 have recovered. Bringing Back Comanche Springs by Nathan Heuer, Part 1 of 3. Charlene Lurig, Chief Executive Officer of Texas Water Trade, made a presentation to the Middle Pecos Groundwater Conservation District Board on October 20th regarding a plan to eventually bring back the Comanche Springs in the Fort Stockton area. Lurig provided a 168-page report at meeting, which included hydrogeology of the springs, use and development of the springs over time, a brief return of the springs, economics of bringing the springs back, and the potential income they could generate if brought back to their natural state, and the plan moving forward with the project. Background information. Comanche Springs was once the sixth largest spring site in Texas before going dry in March of 1961. The springs date back for thousands of years and once sustained a desert ecosystem through the 1950s. The springs stopped flowing steadily beginning in the 1950s when pumped irrigated agriculture expanded 8 miles west of Fort Stockton, the Leon Belding area. Groundwater production in the Edwards Trinity Aquifer area caused spring flows to decline significantly in the 1950s, leading to a seminal court case, Pecos County Water Control and Improvement District No. 11, versus Williams and others, which determined that under the rule of capture, no liability could be assessed against groundwater irrigators. Then in 1986, Comanche Springs' spring flows returned in the winter and sparked the formation of the Groundwater Conservation District in 1999 and confirmation in 2002. Since 2011, the spring flows have returned every winter. The consistent return of seasonal flow to Comanche Springs over the past decade brought about the question of what it would take to bring back the spring flow year-round. The study of history of the springs, a review of what science is known about the aquifer, an assessment of the economics, and appraisal of 5 local groundwater policies is currently being conducted in a combined effort by the Meadows Center for Water and the Environment at Texas State University, Texas Water Trade, West Water Research, and Blue Creek Consulting. Part 2 and 3 of the Bringing Back Comanche Springs series will include a step-by-step process of what will need to take place to get the springs back for the entire year, time frame on how long it'll take to potentially do so, and the potential benefit the Fort Stockton community could see if the springs are flowing year-round. Pecos County Memorial Hospital receives 3 additional ventilators, by Nathan Hewer. Before last weekend, Pecos County Memorial Hospital only had 2 ventilators on its campus to aid in those fighting COVID-19. That number more than doubled this past weekend as the hospital received 3 more ventilators from the Texas Department of Emergency Management by way of El Paso. The news was reported at the Pecos County Commissioner's Court regular meeting on Monday, October 26th. The ventilators came at no expense to the county or the hospital. The county acted upon getting the extra ventilators when hospitalizations reached 6 people last week. "We only had 2 ventilators to begin with, and when we had 6 people in there at one time, we thought it was important to get extra ones because there is no telling what will happen," Pecos County Judge Joe Schuster said at Monday's meeting. As of Tuesday, October 27th, there is 1 person hospitalized at PCMH. Burn ban extended 90 days in Pecos County. Pecos County Emergency Management Coordinator and Fort Stockton Fire Chief Jesse Dominguez reported at the commissioner's meeting on Monday that Keach-Byram drought index for Pecos County was at an average of 590, with some areas reaching as high as 700. Dominguez indicated that any number below 300 is considered good, which led to a recommendation to extending the burn ban in the county for 90 more days. The ban had currently been in place 90 days previously. The commissioners decided to extend the burn ban to January 23, 2021. The drought index ranges from 0 to 800, where a drought index of 0 represents no moisture depletion, and an index of 800 represents absolutely dry conditions. Presently, the index is derived from ground-based estimates of temperature and precipitation derived from weather stations and interpolated manually by experts at the Texas Forest Service, TFS, for counties across the state. County to consider new temperature scanners, by Nathan Hewer. The Pecos County Commissioner's Court is considering new temperature scanners for the court system after a presentation by Eddie Longoria from Team First Technologies at the commissioner's regular meeting on October 13th. Longoria set up a GoSafe temperature scanner at the meeting to show the commissioners how exactly they could use the device. The scanner would sit on a stand, and those entering a court or any given place would just need to walk up to the device to scan their temps and ensure they were wearing a mask. If a mask is not worn, it would not approve the scan. The technology, which would be $2,300 per scanner and stand, also has facial recognition software that can save up to 30,000 images and save when a person leaves and enters the specific area of use. Pecos County Judge Joe Schuster noted after the meeting that he would need to discuss with a district court in Fort Stockton if they would want to have the technology for their court. As for county court, Schuster said he'd like to get a few of the scanners with the facial recognition software, which could be used for many gatherings outside of court sessions. The devices would replace handheld temperature scanners that are currently being used by the county court. Hypothetically, we'd get 2 or 3. It's something that'd be used in the court building, and if we have large gatherings of people in the future, we'd use them at the gatherings. TI could be used for other purposes too, he said. The county judge added that research will be done in collaboration with the district court system before making a decision on the temperature scanner in the near future. Do something. Your guide to local places to go and things to do. Friday, December 4th, the Season of Hope 2020 Christmas Parade will be held on Friday, December 4th at 6:30 p.m. Parade lineup begins at 5:30 p.m. on Rio Street. Contact the chamber after 10 a.m. Friday, December 4th to get your assigned lineup spot. Assignments are subject to change. Check in at lineup to confirm. Please visit www.fortstockton.org/events to see COVID-19 guidelines and restrictions for the event.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, October 29th. Mississippi man charged with negligent homicide in crash. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A Mississippi man has been charged with two counts of criminally negligent homicide for a crash he was involved in, which killed two people in February. Matthew Cade McKenzie, age 22, of Canton, Mississippi, was driving a 2017 Ford F-250 pickup eastbound on Business 20 near Barstow just before 7:30 a.m. on February 10th when he allegedly failed to drive in a single lane of traffic and veered into the westbound lane, hitting a 2019 Nissan Titan driven by Horacio Acosta Ramirez, age 37, of El Paso, head-on. The crash killed Acosta Ramirez and his passenger, Rene M. Cruz, age 55, of Odessa. Ward County Precinct 1 Justice of the Peace Elizabeth Polanco pronounced Acosta Ramirez dead at the scene, while Cruz was pronounced dead by Reeves County Precinct 2 Justice of the Peace Jim Riley. At the time of the crash, McKenzie admitted to Texas Department of Public Safety troopers on the scene that he fell asleep while traveling toward Barstow on Business I-20. McKenzie was transported to Reeves County Hospital by Pecos EMS. According to Sergeant Oscar Villarreal, Safety Education and Media Communications for Texas Highway Patrol, the trooper observed some raw marijuana in a glass jar inside of McKenzie's vehicle, which prompted a blood test to be taken at Reeves County Hospital. Quote, "The results of the blood test showed McKenzie to be under the influence of marijuana and cocaine at the time of the crash," he added. Villarreal said both Acosta Ramirez and Cruz were wearing seatbelts at the time of the crash, as were McKenzie and three passengers with him in the Ford pickup, identified as Brandon Manuel, age 33, of Cave City, Arkansas, Jeremy Robinson, age 36, of Tombsuba, Mississippi, and Deontay Williams, age 24, of Greenville, Mississippi. Manuel, Robinson, and Williams all were taken to Medical Center Hospital in Odessa, but with what were described as non-incapacitating injuries. McKenzie was booked into the Ward County Jail on October 19th for the two Ward County warrants of criminally negligent homicide, state jail felonies. Bond was set at $5,000 for each offense, and McKenzie posted the $10,000 bond and was released on October 20th. The offense can be punishable by imprisonment in a state jail facility for any term of not more than 2 years or less than 180 days, and a fine not to exceed $10,000. DPS Trooper David Wilbanks of Monahans assisted with the crash investigation. Along with Pecos EMS, fire department crews from Barstow and Pecos and Ward County Sheriff's Department deputies all responded to the scene of the crash, which forced the closure of Business I-20 for several hours. Heavy voter turnout in early voting. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. With less than a week to go until the November 3rd general election, Ward County voters had cast 2,278 ballots as of 9 a.m. Wednesday morning. Over 36% of the county's 6,272 voters have cast ballots. Early voting will continue until Friday. The Ward County clerk has added extra hours to enable more people to cast their votes. The office was scheduled to be open from 8 a.m. until 7 p.m. on Wednesday, 8 a.m. until 5 p.m. on Thursday, and 8 a.m. until 7 p.m. on Friday, October 30th. Ballots can be cast in the clerk's office in Suite 101 of the Ward County Courthouse at 400 South Allen Street. The clerk's office will close at noon on Monday, November 2nd, in order to prepare for the election. The office will be open on Tuesday, but land records will not be processed. The office will be closed to the public all day on Wednesday in order to pick up equipment from the polling places and final election processing. Polling places for the Tuesday, November 3rd election are Precincts 1E, 2, 3N, and 4E, the Ward County Event Center at 1525 Monahans Parkway. Precinct 1W, Barstow Community Center, 100 East Concho Street in Barstow. Precinct 3S, Grand Falls Community Center, 711 North Avenue A in Grand Falls. Precinct 4M, Wickett Community Center, 501 North O'Brien Street in Wickett. Precinct 4W, Pyote Community Center, 1108 North Ward Street in Pyote. Commissioners hear battery storage proposal. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. A presentation for a proposed $70 million battery storage project in Ward County was presented on behalf of Jupiter Power by tax service representatives of Ernst & Young Corporation of Austin during Monday's regular meeting of the Ward County Commissioners. The presentation was informational only, and any actions will be taken in future meetings. Evan Horn and Troy Reed explained that the proposed battery storage unit will be located on a 4.5-acre property located about 8 miles south of Pyote on FM 1927, which is currently University of Texas lands. Horn said the large storage battery will produce 100 megawatts of electricity at 25,000 volts for up to 2 hours without recharging, which is enough to provide electricity to 100,000 homes. Cost of the project was stated at about $70 million, with $60 million in tangible assets. Targeted in-service date is the summer of 2021. Quote, "The battery will provide electricity to the Texas power grid when demand and cost is high, and charge the battery from the grid while demand and cost is high. This will help balance the high fluctuations in the cost of electricity and may help lower electric costs to consumers," Horn said. Reed presented two tax abatement possibilities, with the first being a 70% tax abatement and the second using a 10-year payments in lieu of tax pilot program. The 70% abatement will produce tax revenue to the county in a declining amount over 10 years as the operation depreciates and will produce about $849,000 for the county's general fund and $217,000 for the FMLR fund over a 10-year period. The pilot program will generate the same amount of money over 10 years, but will be a flat payment rate every year instead of a declining value. The pilot program will provide nearly $85,000 every year for the general fund and $21,000 for FMLR fund. Both plans are based on tax rates of the $60 million initial investment. Quote, "Currently, the county is only getting a few cents in tax revenue from this property, and the battery storage unit will produce significantly more revenue to the county than that," Reed said. Continuing the quote, "There will also be very little expense to the county. During construction, about 25 to 50 jobs will be created. After that, only one person will be required for routine maintenance. So there will be very little traffic on county roads and little risk of fire or other hazards," Horn said. Commissioner Dexter Nichols asked about the safety, since batteries can sometimes be volatile. Quote, "It is true the lithium-ion batteries that will be used can be volatile, but the batteries will be contained in several storage-type containers, and each will have their own fire suppression protection using a foam suppressant. It will be contained in just that one container, Horn said. Ward County Commissioners approved the tax roll for tax year 2020 and set the dates for holidays and Commissioners Court meetings for 2021. Library open for business at temporary location. Archives closed. The story was written by Dixie Briggs. While the Ward County Library is currently undergoing a renovation, it is still open for the most part at its temporary location at 300 East 4th Street. At the same time, the Ward County Archives, which was absorbed by the county several years ago, will not be open until the renovation is complete, Library Director Brenda Kizier said. The renovation of the library at 409 South Dwight Avenue is projected to be finished in 1 to 2 years, she said. In the meantime, the library has most of its book collection available to the public, as well as several computers and free Wi-Fi that can be accessed from the parking lot when the library is closed. Kizier said that the library is also still offering copying and faxing services as usual. Quote, "We are a little condensed, but still fully operational," she said. When the renovation is finished, the plan is for there to be an entryway connecting the library with the archives. The archives contain a treasure trove of information pertaining to the history of Ward County, including the Sandhills and how Monahans was named. Unfortunately, for the duration of the renovation, the archives are packed away and will not be accessible until the renovation is complete, Kizier said. COVID-19 cases up. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. The number of COVID-19 cases in Ward County are ticking upward with increases in both confirmed and probable cases. As of Wednesday morning, there were 4 confirmed cases and 17 probable. Overall, there has been 166 cases confirmed, 160 recovered, and 2 deaths. Probable cases to date are 84 cases, with 66 recovered and 1 death. A total of 1,162 tests have been administered locally, with 24 pending. On Tuesday, there were no confirmed cases, with 6 probable. Ward County Judge Greg Holly said, quote, "As you can see, our number of active cases, mostly probable cases, increased in today's report. These cases were likely reported over the weekend and are making it to the county reports today. In addition, a significant number of local tests, 24, are currently pending. Of note also is the fact that several of our active cases are from households, addresses, where more than one person is infected. We currently have at least 4 in these situations where multiple persons from the same address are reported as active," end quote. Resident asks for sticker and ant control at cemetery. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Although not on the Tuesday Monahan City Council agenda, Teresa Stoner spoke briefly with the council about the ongoing goat head and ant problem at the Monahan's Memorial Cemetery. Quote, "It is really disappointing to see the state our cemetery is in. It is a disgrace, and to me this is a dishonor to my late husband," Stoner said. Stoner's first husband passed away in 1981 and is buried in the cemetery, as are several other members of her family. After learning a method to restore her late husband's footstone, Stoner and her husband David visited the cemetery and thought the footstone had been removed. Quote, "In May, my husband and I wanted to put a plan together to restore the footstone, and we couldn't find it. It was then that we realized it was completely covered by goat heads, she said. Stoner mentioned another issue was the abundance of ants at the cemetery. Quote, I have 24 family members buried at this cemetery, so the condition is important to me, and unfortunately this is not a new problem, she said. Stoner's husband had taken it upon himself to tend to the goathead and ant problems at the cemetery. Quote, David has gone out there 3 and 4 times a week with weed and ant killer, and even reseeded, trying to get grass to grow, because when the grounds were mowed, it is scalped. He has also watered the grass. I have married a good man, and I am so appreciative of him, but this isn't his job, Stoner said. Stoner said, quote, it seems to me the ballparks and soccer fields are in good shape and do not have the ant and goat head problems the cemetery does. If it can be done there, I don't understand why it cannot be done in our city's cemetery to honor the resting place of people we love, she said. We all need to do something to make the cemetery a place we're proud of, she said. Mayor Pro Tem Jeppy Wilson thanked Stoner for speaking to the council and agreed her concerns were valid. City Manager Rex Thieves said, quote, we know this has been an ongoing problem, and one of the problems this year is they stopped manufacturing the chemical used to treat the goat heads, Balin Surflan XL2G, and we have been looking for a product that will do the job, end quote. The city used $6,500 worth of chemical on the cemetery alone this year, which Thieves said helped with the stickers and ants. In 2018, the city unveiled a weed, sticker, goat heads, and ant control plan to help treat the ongoing problem. Quote, the application plan is still the same, and we're still using the same chemicals with the exception of the Balan, the mowers with blower vacuum baggers, and the self-propelled chemical sprayer, and we will keep on it and tackling the problem, Thee said. Thee added, quote, the ballparks and soccer fields are able to be burned off a few times a year. They also use reclaimed water, which both help control the goathead problem, end quote. Along with Thee and Wilson, council members Richard Hawkins and Calvin Carroll were both present for the meeting. Councilman Rudy Hernandez and Ivy Valenzuela were absent. The next city council meeting will be held at 3 p.m. on Tuesday, November 10th, in council chambers at City Hall at 112 West 2nd Street.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.